again, and welcome to another episode of BitNote. We'll be playing video game music and having some fun. Hope you guys enjoy, and this is David Collins. All right, we're going to start the show with something zany, specifically from Zany Golf. And that's quite a zany start to the show, and in the game soundtrack, it only gets zanier. That is from Zany Golf. It was developed by Sandcastle Productions, and that was just the intro theme by Douglas Fulton. Zany Golf was a classic game originally released on the Amiga, and then, of course, released for a couple of platforms otherwise. It was actually one of my favorite games. It was mini golf, you know, crazy golf, but it wasn't just crazy, it was zany. Yes, I know I'm overusing that word a bit. Let me explain. The first level starts pretty almost mundanely, right? You've got the standard isometric sort of like 2D view when you click and drag on the golf ball and then it putts and it bounces around the size. It's basically like mini golf. And of course, the first level is pretty normal. You're dealing with a windmill. And of course, you have to make sure that the ball goes, you know, between the blades of the windmill and into the hole. So standard golf. The next level takes place where the hole is under a great big hamburger. Yeah, this is where it starts to get a little interesting. In the second level, you basically have to bounce your ball off a bottle of tomato ketchup. Once you do, it squirts ketchup, which is just graphical. And meanwhile, you have to keep clicking to get this hamburger that's in the center of the stage to keep bouncing up and down. You know, bouncing up and down so that it can suddenly, so that when you actually have a chance of getting the ball in. And then it's really tricky because you have to time your shot so that it goes into the hole when that gigantic burger is bouncing upwards. And it's not just a regular bounce, like it's the whole thing, the whole burger spreads out so you can see all the different layers at the height of the bounce, then it all scrunches back down and bounces. And from then on, it just gets more and more crazy. Each level basically is gimmicks or strange things or fun things. You know, there's like fans at one stage that control how you move the ball, or there's small little pads where you can control the ball for short periods of time. I mean, this is like full on surrealist. This is what like a lot of games have been fun. They're just going completely crazy, run with the concept, and just have as much fun as possible. And then, of course, I think one of my favorites, the pinball level. Yes, there's actually a level where you put your golf ball into a large size pinball machine, and then have to, you know, control your bumpers and keep hitting the ball until it gets in the right place so that it can finally go into the hole at the end of the course. As you can see, quite a lot of variety to it there. The soundtrack, of course, adds to it. You've got a lot more tracks like that in various and different ways and, like, coming up with all sorts of crazy sounds. So it's just, I just really enjoyed playing it, trying to get through, seeing all the crazy courses. It's a short amount of holes, but you've only got so many balls and you got to make it through the whole level, so it's quite a challenge. So, I think it's time for our next game music bit, and this is a nice tune, all right. It's from a game that's basically, you know, the way that sometimes game franchises go when there's like maybe a good game to start it off, and then there's another good game and people go, and then maybe there's a bad game, good game, blah blah blah. Well, this is from a series where there was a good game, a good game, a good game, and then a gigantically hugely successful game that ended up sweeping out pretty much everything after it. And basically this was a game that became so good that the previous games that before it were kind of fell out of the sight. But I certainly played one of those games and it was good, and have a listen. That's just great music there. And that was from Warcraft 2 by Blizzard. And the music you just heard was the human music, well, part of the human music, and it was by Glenn Stafford, who's basically went on to deal with production a huge amount of Blizzard's music. Well, Blizzard, of course, is a huge name when it comes to making PC games, but let's just go back. This was Warcraft. Warcraft is basically an RTS, real-time strategy game, and like a lot of it, it's basically pretty straightforward. You've got a given area, you have to. There's a couple of resources in your area, like trees or mines or whatever. You have to gather those resources, build buildings, then use those buildings to produce troops and arms, armaments and other things of war, and build an army and then destroy your enemy. So it's basically build a city so you can build an army so you can annihilate your enemy. That's pretty much most RTS games in a nutshell. Now, RTS games, now normally how most people play RTS games, they just gigantically generate a huge army and completely swamp the enemy, but other games feel that that's a little tricky, so they do mechanics to prevent against that. Personally, sometimes it's kind of personally, I don't sort of like those games because building a gigantic army and completely utterly stomping your enemy is kind of like my favorite part of an RTS game, so sue me. With Warcraft 2, of course, it's not just the regular, you know, like in Red Alert, where it's basically an alternate history where you're dealing with the Allies versus the Soviets and stuff. With Warcraft, you're basically dealing with orcs and humans. So there's one team called the humans, one team called the orcs. I play as human and generally, and, you know, you basically have to build a lot of stuff. You've got to build, like, barracks to make your troops, and you've got to have people go to the mines and get all like the coal and stuff, and you can also have them cut down trees to get wood. And it's that really did teach me a lesson about deforestation, because I remember a couple of times as like playing the game early on, you know, I'd get the next level and say, whoa, look at this gigantic forest right next to my base, you know, that's never going to have any problems, you know, that's going to last me forever. So I'd like assign like whole did a worker to cut down the trees, and later on in the game I'm going, I need a bit more wood, and then I look at the trees and just see this gigantic field of stumps. Tree stumps just swamping the entire area. And I'm going, okay, I think I need to go a little more easy on collecting the wood. And by that stage, of course, I'd usually have collected enough resources to still annihilate the enemy. But it's just an example of how you got to be tricky about these things, my friend. As in all RTSs, you know, you can build up a crazy army of basically a whole lot of diverse units, like, you know, archers and, of course, wizards. And, of course, my favourite, the Basilica, which basically shot these gigantic wooden arrows at your enemies, usually which seem to explode. And, of course, there's nothing quite like just getting a whole troop of Basilicas and then gradually creeping them forward into position and blowing stuff up. In fact, one of actually the levels of the game, you know, you obviously get the big army and you can select them to attack the enemy, and sometimes you gotta be careful because the enemy might have defenses or turrets or just great big towers that might rain down things. Of course, you can build the towers too to defend your things, and both armies are, but it's just one time you need to be a little strategic. One time I noticed there was just this great big enemy base, and like all enemy bases, the entrance was heavily fortified by these towers. They had all the armies and everything. So what I did was I created a couple of basilicas, you know, the great big, you know, shooting arrow explodey things, and of course had my normal gigantic army of humans and soldiers and everything, and I brought them into position along the side of the camp. Now at the front there were all the turrets, but at the sides there was just a gigantic forest. So what I did was I commanded the basilicas to directly attack the forest, and they blew over a great swathe of the forest, and gradually I kept blowing them in until they created this great big inroad through the forest, and then I had them destroy the enemy wall while it was weak there. And I basically had my entire forces pour in through that side in the wall, destroy pretty much every single building that could possibly generate more additional enemy units, and basically swamp the entire enemy base. And I just loved that. I mean, you know, why go in the front door when you can destroy huge amounts of National Wildlife Preserve and effectively screw your enemy from the side? Like all RTS games, you can get various of your army units to get additional abilities. I remember one time I got my wizard to learn a really powerful spell, and I was wondering, what does it do? So I clicked, and base has an enemy was approaching, and the enemy turned into a sheep. So one of the powerful attacks, Warcraft 2, one of the most powerful attacks is turning one of your enemy opponents into a sheep. Although, to be honest, actually, I never had always had trouble with that spell because I never really used it in battle. I was more used to clicking and dragging over a gigantic army and just clicking to attack a single thing. But yeah, like I said, the game just had basically there was the orcs and the humans. Depending on which one you chose at the beginning of the game, you get a slight you get a different storyline and you get a different set of troops because each side was slightly different. Obviously, this game is more like inclined to actually battle. It works well for like playing competitively, you know, with people online. But most of the time, whenever I go online, I'm just deal with people who are far more professional, play the game a lot more than me. So I just play through the single player campaign. One thing the game always has is that is personality. I read this really interesting article online a while back that I can't seem to find again. But its point was basically that there was a very popular game called another Blizzard game called StarCraft, which is a real-time strategy, and yet there was a competitor which was Total Annihilation. Now, a lot of people said that Total Annihilation was better, but StarCraft was the success, was turned out to be a huge success, while Total Annihilation was doomed to a cult status, if that's really that bad a doom, but it happens. And one of the things they said was, you know, Total Annihilation had robots, whereas StarCraft had all these different crazy, you know, aliens with different personalities and everything. So the article was saying the important thing in a lot of games is personality, and it's something a lot of people miss. It's hard to empathize with a bunch of robots. It's of course not impossible, but it's hard. And I suppose when I think of that article, I think back to Warcraft, and I thought, you know, the game did have a lot of personality. It was a lot of fun. Like I said, there were soldiers and flying animals and wizards and all these great big, like, armaments and stuff. And it was all just a lot of fun. But one thing I remember a lot pretty well about the games was that when you clicked on a character to get them to move anywhere, you'd hear a little voice command from them, you know. So it'd be like... Yeah, you know, for instance, if it was like one of your like noble disciplined things, he would say, "Awaiting your command." And then when you clicked where he was meant to go, it'd say, "Very well." And there were there was of course the workers, which were meant to be like, you know, simpletons effectively. It was, you know, so you click and they go, "Yes, rightio," whenever they, and it's just all these nice little things, all these nice little touches that gave them bits of personality, you know, the bright color palette, the way you could move them around, and it gives the game a lot of feedback, and in a lot of ways I think it makes the game experience a lot better, because you're not like getting a technical understanding about, you know, who they are in terms of, you know, like what their stats or numbers or abilities are, but they also are more personal. They've got a human characteristic, so something you can relate to. And I mean, that's something that a lot of good games capitalize well on. Now, of course, it's a little tricky because you're saying, oh, whatever your first impression of this character is, that's completely the right attributes, although it's usually not that case, you know. Yeah, in any video game you learn a lot more, but it's just, I like a lot of games that just, you know, that have that human aspect, that have a bit of personality, that has something that really engages you in it. I've talked on this show before about Team Fortress 2, where there's you can play like as a spy or a sniper or a great big, you know, heavy guy with a great big chain gun, and all of them have got really strong personalities. You hear their personalities both in comments they make and their visual design, and and the company that made Team Fortress 2 even put internet videos online about their dip that were basically gave more insight into these characters. So I suppose when you got that personal attachment to the characters and that sense of personality to it, it just helps you engage more and have more fun with the game and the characters and everything involved. The funny thing, of course, with early games, you almost didn't need to worry about personality. I mean, I'm overstretching things a bit, but characters by default were almost always bright and colourful. I mean, like, you know, even especially with Sonic the Hedgehog came, you know, great big blue hedgehog and all these different characters. You'd have like Marco's Magic Football, where, you know, British kid kicks around a football and stuff. These days, however, I mean, as games got more realistic and we could depict actual humans, I think it became a little harder for the characters to actually, you know, have real characteristics, humor and personality. I think part of it is because, you know, of course, people weren't sure what sort of personality would sell, so they just created a very generic one that's been known to sell well. And in some cases, they don't even give the player character personality at all. You know, you're just, you know, there's just a blank slate you're meant to project yourself onto. But I just think about like games like Warcraft and realize, you know, personality, you know, various ways of engagement, they can really get you involved in the game. And I think it's good to have more of that sort of stuff. Of course, even though games do get realistic, there's always a few crazy ones. And I think I'll just play some music from a game that sort of fits the definition of crazy pretty damn well. And the music you just heard was the menu theme from Feel the Magic XYXX by Sega. And the music of that game was composed by Naofumi Hatia, Tomo Sasaki, and Mariko Nanba. As I've said, it's sometimes tricky to know exactly who was involved in that track, but they all made a good effort. Feel the Magic was an early title released for the Nintendo DS. Now, I suppose maybe some of you, of course, now think, oh, Nintendo DS was probably that hugely successful Nintendo handheld console with two screens and a touchscreen and everything that's currently got a 3DS version. But back when it was released, it was actually an unsafe bet. A lot of people were wondering, heck, is this thing even going to be successful? And essentially, the entire console was very weird. I mean, handheld consoles were established at the time. You had one screen, some control method of control like a D-pad on the left and some buttons on the right, maybe some shoulder buttons, and that was it. And here the Nintendo DS came along and said, oh, wait a sec, we've got two screens. And not only do we have two screens, we've also got a microphone. Not only do we have a microphone, but the bottom screen is completely touchscreen, so you can control the game by using touch. And people were going, wait, what? I mean, keep in mind, this is way before the iPhone or anything. You know, the idea of just making a game that's completely touchscreen, I mean, sure, it had been done in various forms, but, like, on a major, this was Nintendo's, like, new handheld console, like, touchscreen and two screens and all this sort of stuff. And so essentially, as what happens whenever a new console or anything with a new technology or form comes out, a lot of games come out that try to experiment with it. And Feel the Magic was one of those games. The whole thing is basically a series of mini-games. And each one of the mini-games usually does something where you touch things, like a whole lot of balls pop up and you have to touch them, or you have to use the microphone by speaking in, or you have to do all these crazy controls using the touchscreen and everything. The whole game is basically just trying to find out as many different, like, little gameplay methods you can use using the power features of the DS as possible. Now, to be honest, a couple of them were a little tricky. I mean, of course, one thing with touchscreen is that you don't get as much responsive as buttons. And I don't know, I thought a lot of the minigames were okay, a little simplistic. I think my favourite minigame was one where you have to sneak into a factory and you've got some guards and they're all shining their torches in different directions. And as the people are sneaking in through a predetermined path, you've got to touch all these dogs on the four sides of the screen to get the guards looking at them. And as they look at them, the guys sneak behind, and there's this whole system of trying to get the right dogs to bark in the right order so the guards are looking in the right direction at the right time so your guys can sneak past. And I thought that was a really, really clever thing. I'm wondering if someone else could do it. And the funny thing was, you don't even need a touchscreen for it, so I'm surprised no one's, like, taken it and put it into another context. But yeah, a lot of the touchscreens were kind of fun. They were trying to stretch and explore new territory, do things in a different way, come up with all these crazy things. And you'd expect a game and do crazy things like slingshots in a car, but you'd expect a game that's just a bunch of mini games thrown together to just have like some sort of chaotic and barely coherent plot that just jumps around and does a lot of crazy things that don't make a lot of sense. And in all fairness, you'd be completely right. That's exactly what the game is. It starts with you being a guy who wears this blue motorcycle helmet, and the game's got a really nice art style where everyone's basically a silhouette with clear definition. I mean, and basically you see a girl and it's love at first sight. And basically the whole game is your very, very weird pursuit of her, except, you know, she's, you know, you try to help her or, like, protect her from all these bulls being running at her, or if she suddenly she gets dirty and you're trying to clean her. Yeah. That's a kind of a weird part of the game, all right? The game does have some weird subtext. But, or save her from a gigantic plant monster by throwing fire logs at it. But the game is kind of got a really weird twisted plotline, and part of the reason is that you're not alone in trying to help your and try to get the affections of the girl. You've also got a gigantic band of performance artists called the Rub Rabbits to help you. Yes, and what's more, that you've got this guy in a gigantic mohawk who's trying to like steal the girl away from you and uses gigantic technologies and everything. So the game, you know, and all this in very abstract, stylish way, which means we don't quite see the girl's face, just a silhouette. And the game is kind of surreal. It's a glarish blend of colors. It's got a glarish music. You're never quite sure what the next stage is going to be like. And the whole game comes off as being very, very weird. Which is fine, of course. It's just kind of, it just makes the game have a very unique style, which is always pretty important. You know, when I was looking up stuff about this, there was one level in the game, which I actually forgot at the since then, that basically has you say into the microphone, "I love you, I love you." And when I was looking online for just music and stuff, I found a clip by Mega64. Now, if you don't know of Mega64, what they do is they basically take scenes in games and try to replicate them in real life with real people to almost hilarious effect. Now, they don't actually do, like, full actors or anything. They literally, you know, dress up in whatever outfit of the game characters, go into the real world, and then interact with people replicating these scenes of the game. It can be pretty hilarious. Usually more hilarious if you actually know the game involved. But in this case, when they did the Rub Rabbits, they basically went around to people saying, "I love you, I love you, I love you." And, yeah, you can see the result if you go online. But, yeah, I think we're just about getting towards the end of our show. To end with, I'll play that other bit of human music from Warcraft 2, which, of course, from Blizzard. Thank you very much for listening. Podcasts are, of course, available for the show on dublinsouthfm.ie. And just to remind everyone, the show broadcasts at 3:30 p.m. on Mondays and repeats at 2 p.m. on Fridays. And, of course, it broadcasts on Dublin South FM, both online and on 93.9 FM. This has been BitNote. Thank you very much for listening.